happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
When Jesus wore,
he washed my sins away.
Oh, happy day.
Oh, happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. I was thinking about this morning, of when someone told me back in 1977, when I was on WBAI, and I came from WMCA, and they said, well, how much longer do you think people are going to hear about health and nutrition? I mean, haven't you said it all? I said, when America's healthy, I will have said it all. But until that time, there's more to say. Today, we'll be talking about that other part, what we can do to stay healthier longer. For example, there's a recent study from the London School of Economics published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, showing that one thing you can do can lower blood pressure better than drugs. What is it? I'm going to share that with you today. But also, not only do we spend at least anywhere from one-third to a half of our program on health issues, but we also do more programming on the environment than any other radio program in America. And we have at least 9 articles. I'm going to go over the headlines to show you why these are important today. And last evening on the Progressive Commentary Hour, we had 2 of the most riveting discussions, one by Dr. Guy McPherson, and he nailed it about the time is now. As the Buddha says, you have no more time. And boy, was he right when it came to where we're at today as far as environmental issues. But McPherson told us the truth, and he was supported in his discussions by another gentleman from New Zealand and Kevin Hester, who was even more emphatic that we have no time left. In fact, Kevin said, when I asked him, give us your best guesstimate. Now, we realize it's a guesstimate. Of how long we have compared to the International Tribunal of Environmental Scientists, nearly 2,000, saying at most we have 12 years. He said we have 2 years or less. McPherson said we have 2 years or less. And then I said, okay, so what happens in 2 years? Whoa. As one person told me after the program, Luann Panessi, she said, Gary, that program scared the hell out of me. I couldn't stop listening to it. Well, these are 2 heavyweights, and especially McPherson, he's a professor emeritus of environmental science. So, for those who could not hear because you're not on the internet or you're not savvy with how to download a program, I'm going to play it on our sister stations tomorrow at noon. It's about how much time do we have left. You won't want to miss it. It is very important. But I'm going to give you some additional updates today on that. Also from our audio file today, we're going to hear from John Oliver about televangelists and also free speech, but at what cost? Next Tuesday, I'm going to have one of the world's leading Gnostic scholars on. He's a spiritual scholar. He is from Oxford University on the Progressive Commentary Hour. That's going to be a real heady show because comparative religion is one of my passions and interests. And I already have a pretty good idea of some of his thoughts, but he is very concerned, according to Richard Gill, who interviewed him, to see if he was right for the show, that we have less free speech today than we did in the 1960s. In fact, the hallmark of free speech in America was the 1960s. So what's happened to all of our free speech? What happened to all of our free speech advocates? Now you can't say anything without someone being offended. So we're going to play a clip today about that. So we have a lot to share. We begin with the latest on health and healing. Exercise may be as effective as prescribed drugs to lower high blood pressure. High blood pressure would be 140 mmHg blood pressure. And that's a whole group of studies that were pulled together and published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. So I think that's very important. Now, I'm not telling people not to take their meds. I don't do that. I'm merely saying that you now have an alternative. You can do the research. And all of my statements come from peer-reviewed literature. But people are not made aware of this. So exercise every day, because exercise has been proven repeatedly to lower systolic blood pressure. Now, by the way, that's the amount of pressure in the arteries when the heart is beating and expresses the top number in any blood pressure reading. But what isn't clear is how exercise compares with blood pressure-lowering drugs, of which there are several types, but the blood pressure-lowering drugs are not good as far as the side effects. And how many research studies they put together? 194 separate clinical studies looking at the impact of drugs on lowering systolic blood pressure, and 197 studies looking at the impact of structured exercise involving over 39,742 people. And by the way, structured exercise simply means endurance, like power walking, jogging, running, cycling, swimming, high-intensity interval training, dynamic resistance, strength training, those kettlebells and isometric resistance. So all that helps lower blood pressure. And yet, when was the last time someone over 40, as an average person — there are certainly exercise enthusiasts, I'm talking about the average person — we're just not exercising enough. That's a big problem. From Yale University, the research published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science showed that sugar targets gut microbes linked to lean and healthy people. So now what we know is sugar can silence a key protein required for colonization by a gut bacterium associated with lean and healthy individuals. The gut microbiota plays a key role in human health, and its composition is associated with diet. So until recently, scientists believed that sugar was absorbed into the intestine and never reached the gut. However, recent studies have shown sugar can travel to the colon, and that's where the microbiota resides. So given the high consumption of sugar and fructose and sucrose in the Western diet, you can see why so many people have gastrointestinal problems and immune problems, because your immune system is no small measure determined by how many good bacteria you have. And just as a side on this, go to prn.fm, look under my articles. Now we've just published 6, by the way, and I'm writing, even today I was writing a new article. We have Death by Medicine coming later this week or next week, part one. It'll be in several parts. And it's all current statistics, using only their official statistics, which they're doing absolutely nothing about. And that's why I'm writing the article, because on the one hand, if you say we are the finest medical facilitator in the world, the U.S. medical industrial complex, the most hospitals, nurses, doctors, technology, pharmaceutical drugs that are miracle drugs, save lives. All right, and we're giving you $3.5 trillion this year. then we should see an awful lot of diseases gone, diseases prevented. And we see just the opposite, more disease and more death due to that medical industrial complex. So there is a big cognitive disconnect between the intent to help and the actual help. So anyhow, you'll see the first part of it. Going back to what I was saying, I published an article long ago called Sweet Suicide, and I keep updating it and changing it. And I wrote the article after I debated on NBC Network, I think his name was Bob Kane show. I debated Dr. Elizabeth Whalen for the, she was with a think group, which is very pro-pharmaceutical and very pro-big sugar companies. The American Council on Science and Health. Now, they have every right to exist, and I don't question or challenge that. But boy, do we share different points of view. And I brought all these studies from peer-reviewed literature showing her how damaging sugar was. And I remember afterwards, she was adamant it wasn't the case. And so afterwards, out by the elevator, I said, would you like these studies? There's over 44 studies I brought. There are more I have. Nope. That was it. Never spoken to her since. Well, I remember going down to Washington, D.C. to the PBS station. I had been on there five times with five original programs, Get Healthy Now, For Women Only, How to Live Forever, were the three big ones, and then two beyond that, Seven Steps to Perfect Health. And I was premiering a new one on the Food Mood Connection. And it was a Thursday. And it wasn't in prime time. And the program director, who had been the program director in Detroit, and I'd worked with him several times in Detroit, and he was now in Washington, so he invited me down. I came down. And afterwards, he came over and he said, well, I've got good news. I said, what's that? He said, you set a record for the most, I think it was $57,000 we raised in not prime time on a Thursday for a program that had not been promoted. It was a replacement for one. And he said, but I also got a call from the head of the local station board. That would be Sharon Rockefeller of the Rockefeller family. Her husband was Jay Rockefeller from West Virginia. And really angry. What was she angry about? Well, you were talking about sugar. In one scene, yes, I actually poured the amount of sugar the average person consumes in a day into a bowl out of a bag. And that bag had been put together by my in-house attorney at the time, David Slater, who's the son of a great feminist lawyer. And so he did it. And I was there, and he had a gram scale. So it's exactly correct. And that sugar still on set, you can measure it for yourself. That's not the point. The point is not, were you accurate? The point was not, were you honest? The point was not, are you telling us the truth? The point is that she has the power here. People who sit on local station boards have the power. And they don't want to see you ever again on the air. And you're probably going to face this around the country. Because she got a call from the Sugar Association. And they were angry, so they called her. Now, I didn't know it at that time, but the next day, by doing research, we found out Sharon Rockefeller also sat on the board of Pepsi-Cola, the people that give us a lot of sugar. So then I researched into all these people on the board, and then I started researching all the national board, and I found, my God, the entire boards of local stations are made up of people who are supporting Big Pharma, Big Med, or Big Food, or Big Wall Street, like Henry Kravitz. And the people I'm in utter contempt of are the equity partners. They're the ones who buy companies, load them with debt, sell off their assets. They struggle, and most of the time they die. Like Bain Capital, Mitt Romney made his fortune being an economic parasite. And that's all he is an economic parasite. He should have been riding in that dog crate on top of his car, not his dog. In any case, these are the people who make money off money, and they forget the moral consequences of how they make money. There's no moral equation. In any case, so I found out all of PBS is just a sewer. All of PBS. I mean, every single city I was just perplexed. I didn't know this. And then it began to occur to me why some stations wouldn't, no matter how successful I'd been, didn't want on, because my message was counter to the official accepted view. They were censoring, but they wouldn't come out and censor it. And so I wrote a letter. And I wrote a letter to Sharon Rockefeller. I wrote the same letter, went to every member of the board of every PBS station in America. We got their home addresses, sent it to them. And then that same letter went to the Sugar Institute, and I challenged them. Come on the radio and debate me. Come on PBS. Any form you want, debate me. And hey, let's play fair. I'll debate 100 of you. Then we're equal. Okay? I cannot tell you the contempt I have for these people who work for these special interest groups, because they have no truth on their side. So I decided to update my article. So I updated it and showed how dangerous sugar is. It's associated with cancer. It's associated with heart disease, associated with diabetes, associated with toothache, associated with diabetes in children. So just think about this for a moment. Here is PBS, a sewer within a sewer, a bunch of dilettantes who pretend that they know something about life and culture, and they're faked. And it's, I call it now, since that time, I call PBS and NPR Wonder Bread for the Brain, because that's all it is, in my opinion. Very biased, very stupid, and not because these people are ignorant. They're not ignorant. They're highly educated. But they have that kind of faux interest in the truth. Oh, yeah, we're interested in the truth. Well, then why don't you expose? Why haven't you ever exposed, ever, all the crimes? And who pays? The Koch brothers are one of your largest sponsors? What does that tell you? Johnson & Johnson, that we now find out has been aware of the dangers of its talcum powder and cancer-causing agents for decades and hid this? So how can these people that are sponsoring these programs and then being pro-pharmaceutical and pro-medicine, how can then NPR or PBS hold themselves up as being objective spotlights to show the truth? They show only a conditional truth of those people behind them. Anyhow, I didn't get a response, but you should read what I wrote them. It's up there. I post all my articles and letters up there. So when the next time someone tells you, well, sugar's not bad, you know, it's good for you, these health nuts, look at the actual peer-reviewed literature that you can find on the Library of Medicine's website and PubMed that the government uses in its own official estimates of the safety of something. It's there. Sugar is a poison. If sugar were invented today for the first time, it would be outlawed as a poison. So would coffee. So I just want to share that with you. So when we're talking about sugar disrupting the gut microbiota, and that in turn can disrupt your immune system, and that also changes a type of protein that is used in the body to keep you lean, and therefore it is contributing to obesity, and therefore that obesity is killing people, and diabetes is killing people, and heart disease is killing people, all contributed by sugar, then this Proceedings of the National Academy of Science article done from Yale University will have some meaning to you. Otherwise, it'll be another one of hundreds of thousands of studies that are important that are not promoted by the mainstream media, because we know who controls the mainstream media. Little background on that. But my articles are always footnoted. Let me explain something. When I write an article, it goes through in-house vetting by in-house scholars. They're hired just to review my material that I put on the radio, write on, doing my films. A whole group of people sit around and view every single scene of every documentary I film to make sure that it's objective, honest, and fair. And then a team of my in-house lawyers review it to make sure that it's legally right and that it could withstand cross-examination at a court of law. So do not fear using the material that somehow it is superficial. It is not. From Silla University Medical College in South Korea comes a story about something that we could eat. It's not available except once a year, mulberries. Now, mulberries are great when you go out there, and I have a couple mulberry trees, and I pick the mulberries because all the animals love them. I mean, every animal loves mulberries. Monkeys eat a bowl of them, and I'll eat a bowl of them, and you should eat a bowl of mulberries. But if you don't eat them fresh, that's fine. Put them in a dehydrator and dry them. Then they're good indefinitely. And if you freeze what you've dehydrated, then you got something that can last a long time. Just put a handful in a smoothie, handful in a salad. But here's what the university found. It improves insulin sensitivity. That's a big deal. Why? Because that means it has anti-diabetic impact. And we need people not to end up having problems with insulin sensitivity. Because then that means that you're not going to be able to control your blood sugar levels. And that means that you're going to end up spiking your blood sugar and insulin levels, and that can lead to inflammation in your brain, Alzheimer's, dementia, poor circulation, a stroke. So you see, there's consequences to insulin insensitivity and diabetes. And this was published in the Journal of Medicinal Food. Also, from the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology, this is surprising. In Norway, researchers at the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology took a look at 72,000 pregnant women, and they found that the dental amalgam fillings, the silver fillings in their mouths, were linked to prenatal deaths. That is significant. Not one, but two new studies associating dental amalgam fillings with pregnancy risks confirm action is urgently needed to protect babies from the known risk to mercury. So what to do? Well, the average American dentist, of course, wouldn't know this, and this was also published in PLOS One, a major peer-reviewed journal, and as well as another study on the International Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine that was published. Quote, the use of dental mercury must be stopped. Quote, no one should have toxic mercury put into their mouth where it continuously leaks, especially when brushing or chewing. These studies validate decades of research demonstrating this outdated dental material poses substantial risk and threat to human health. And by the way, this past summer, the European Parliament enacted a ban on dental amalgam fillings for children under 15 and pregnant and breastfeeding women, with consideration for banning dental amalgams completely in the near future. In the United States, no, that's not going to happen. So if you have a desire to be pregnant, first have, through a holistic dentist, have all your mercury fillings removed, then detoxify to get the mercury in your body out. And chlorophyll can do that very effectively, liquid chlorophyll, spirulina, wheatgrass juice, chlorella, and vitamin C are outstanding chelators of mercury. And the gut microbiome regulates the intestinal immune system, according to Brown University. I just mentioned that. So scientists have long known that bacteria in the intestines, also known as the microbiome, perform a very useful set of functions for the person. Like it breaks down dietary fiber in the digestive process, it makes vitamin K and vitamin B7, but it also is crucial to having a healthy immune system. One more reason to make sure you're not taking in the alcohol, the meat, the refined carbohydrates, and the sugars, which destroy all that. And if you want to know how to help with the hepatocellular carcinoma, ginger and its polysaccharide induce cell cycle arrest and death in those carcinoma cells. And this was from the International Journal of Biological Microbiology and done at Shandong Agricultural University in China. So ginger juice for people with cancer. And finally, from Manchester Metropolitan Bioscience Research Center, junk food, that's the entire American diet and 100% of the British diet, raises depression risk. That's right. A diet of fast foods and cakes and processed meats increase your risk of depression. And that's what this research found. That shouldn't be surprising because we know there's been an association between that. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to come right back into a segment from John Oliver, and I think you'll find it interesting. Back in a moment.
Churches are a cornerstone of American life. There are roughly 350,000 congregations in the United States, and many of them do great work, feeding the hungry, clothing the poor. But this is not a story about them. This is about the churches who exploit people's faith for monetary gain. And when I say that, you probably think of 1980s televangelists like this guy.
I'm just getting into a prophetic vein. Someone with a digestive tract problems, quickly call. We've seen midgets grow. We've seen arms and legs that stop growing because the growth cells that stop. I don't make this stuff up.
Please, you can't say I don't make this stuff up just 5 seconds after you said the words Manda Kasabasanda. That man is Robert Tilton, and though he, like many televangelists, was caught up in an expose decades ago, he never really went away.
Healing, go into those knees. Arthritis, go in the name of Jesus. Tumors, go in the name of Jesus. That one calling with lupus. Lupus, you foul devil, you bow to the name of Jesus. Lupus, you bow to the name of Jesus. You go in Jesus' name.
Lupus, you complicated and not especially easy to describe malady. You go, lupus. You vex us with your foul lupusness. You go. Now, though you may not be aware of it, televangelism is still thriving in this country, and Robert Tilton is just a very small part of it. There are several large media networks devoted to televangelism, including Trinity, Inspiration Ministries, and Daystar. And the preachers that appear on them can have incredible lifestyles. Just earlier this year, a man named Creflo Dollar got people's attention with a bold request.
Pastor Creflo Dollar of the World Changers Church International facing harsh criticism after starting a fundraising campaign to buy this $65 million luxury private jet.
If I want to believe God for a $65 million plane, you cannot stop me. You cannot stop me from dreaming.
You cannot stop me from dreaming is not how you ask for $65 million. It's what you scream at your father when he tells you you'll never be a Broadway dancer. I can do it, Dad! I've got the music in me! But here's the thing. Creflo Dollar wanting a private jet is not remotely unusual. There is a pattern of preachers wanting high-end airplanes, and when they get them, they're not always particularly humble about it.
I had enough money to buy a beautiful Cessna Citation jet, cash. And since there's so much jealousy in this room tonight that I can feel over this, a few weeks later, I bought another one worth three times what that one was, cash. Act happy over my blessing, folks.
I bought a jet cash, I bought a bigger jet cash, f*** the haters, act happy for me. That's not a sermon, it's the first draft of a Rick Ross single. Now, preachers claim these planes are vital tools. Look at Kenneth Copeland, who along with his wife Gloria are among the most successful TV evangelists. A few years back, he asked his followers to help buy a $20 million jet, promising it would only be used
for church business. But a local news crew did some digging, and what they found will probably not surprise you.
It was a News 8 investigation last February which first raised questions about Copeland's apparently personal use of his new church jet.
This is a preaching machine.
Most notably for a ski trip to Colorado and visits to an exotic game ranch in South Texas. Here's Copeland and his son John proudly posing with a pair of axis deer indigenous to India and Sri Lanka.
This guy's like a psychotic reverse Noah. Two by two, male and female, came to Kenneth Copeland and he doth shot them right between the f***ing eyes. Now, Copeland's ministry will tell you that he reimburses the church for trips like that, but that still means he has private jet reimbursement money. And yet, despite that personal wealth, people still send Kenneth Copeland, Creflo Dollar, and that with two planes, lots and lots of money. And that's partly because they preach something called the prosperity gospel, which argues that wealth is a sign of God's favor, and donations will result in wealth coming back to you. That idea sometimes takes the form of seed faith, the notion that donations are seeds that you will one day get to harvest. Let me show you that in action.
The size of your seed will determine the size of your harvest. I don't understand why, but there's something happens at a level where people step into faith and give $1,000 that don't happen at other levels.
You're going to have a breakthrough through this $273 seed.
All you've got is $1,000. Listen, that's not enough money anyway to buy the house. You're trying to get in the apartment. You're trying to buy the house. That's not enough money anyway. You get to that phone and you put that seed in the ground and watch God work it out.
The argument is, sow your money in the ground and you will reap returns multiple times over. Except, as an investment, you'd be better off burying your money in the actual ground. Because at least that way, there is a chance your dog may dig it up and give it back to you one day. Good boy. But it can get even more predatory. Because if, say, you don't have $1,000 or perhaps have significant credit card debts, seed faith can still work for you.
I have a feeling that somebody that wants a credit card debt wiped out, that if you'll use your faith as you sow the $1,000 on a credit card, as you use your faith, God's going to wipe out your credit card indebtedness.
Think about that. That is the equivalent of saying the key to you losing weight lies at the bottom of this giant Costco bulk bag of peanut butter M&Ms. Go find it. It's definitely down there. And all of this would be amusing if the targets of these messages were not often vulnerable people like Bonnie Parker. She did not seek medical treatment for cancer, instead choosing to sow money into Kenneth Copeland's church. And I'll let her daughter pick it up from there.
I started finding notebooks. Not long after she passed away, she believed, and I know she believed because it's in the notebooks, that if she sowed enough seed, which was money, the greater amount of seed that you sow, according to them, the better chance you have of getting healed.
At this point, I think it's clear that seed faith is the most disgusting seed-based concept since whatever the fuck chia seed pudding is. Bonnie Parker gave thousands of dollars to the Copeland's church because she believed it was her best chance of beating cancer. And you might think, well, that's crazy. But it's not an unreasonable interpretation of the Copeland's preachings. Gloria Copeland sells numerous products on healing through faith and has been skeptical in the past about going to the doctor.
We know what's wrong with you. You've got cancer. The bad news is we don't know what to do about it, except give you some poison that'll make you sicker. Now, which do you want to do? Do you want to do that, or you want to sit here on Saturday morning, hear the word of God, and let faith come into your heart and be healed? Hallelujah.
It's pretty clear that woman cannot hear the word of God, because if she could, I'm pretty sure he'd be shouting, "F*** you, Gloria," right in her ear. And yet, not only is everything you've seen so far legal, but the money people donate in response to it is tax-free. Because if you're registered as a religious nonprofit, or especially a church, you...
And that was John Oliver. It just shows you, unfortunately, how many people are susceptible to these evangelical pitches. But what happens when that person goes to vote? What happens when they accept someone else's ideological base? When their spokesperson is Rush Limbaugh or, you know, someone on the left who could be equally delusional and wrong and frequently is. I just don't believe that we understand how many people are vulnerable to being influenced by people they perceive as more enlightened, more connected to a truth that somehow they need that connection in order to stay positive in some way, healed in some way. It's just, it's our entire body politic, because more often than not, if you look at the politicians, both left and right, they're aligned with these ministries. And we should have that separation of church and state, and we don't. Now we're going to hear from a part of a clip called Free Speech at What Cost, and let us, we can agree or disagree with it. I just found it was interesting enough when I'm listening to these that I think this is worthy of creating a discussion on. Let's hear it now.
In the state of free speech, we welcome, in our nation's capital, Rachel DeCoste. She's a community organizer, motivational speaker, and Huffington Post blogger. And with us here in studio, Janice Fiamengo, professor of English at the University of Ottawa, Alice McLaughlin, professor of philosophy at York University, and Justin Trottier, national policy director at the Center for Inquiry. And we welcome you three here in our studio. And Rachel, nice to have you on the line from Ottawa. Janice, I want to start with you because you've given a number of talks where loud demonstrations have met your attempts to give talks, most recently, I guess, at Queen's University. Let's just start with this. What do you think it is about your appearances that causes so much controversy?
Well, clearly my my talks are challenging a very much cherished and deeply held series of beliefs, particularly feminist ideology, because I have been questioning some of the major tenets of feminist ideology, and I've also been trying to make the case that men's issues deserve to be heard as well, and there's a certain element in the feminist community on campus that doesn't want to hear that and is finds it threatening in various ways.
Having said that, do you understand the intensity of the reaction you run into when you try to advance your views?
Sure, absolutely. I was a radical feminist when I was younger. I was a radical student. I still believe in protest. I believe that students have the right to challenge very vigorously and aggressively speakers with whom they disagree. I guess where I draw the line is actually shutting down a speaker, which is what happened to me at the University of Ottawa. I wasn't even able to begin the talk, and I did eventually, after an hour of interruption, speak for about 15 minutes before the fire alarm went off. Obviously, the useful Q&A that we were looking forward to couldn't take place, and I think discussions around these charged issues are really damaged when that kind of discussion can't take place. So that's too bad.
Okay, Justin, to you now. Gender issues are one thing. Do you want to put a few more things on the list where these kinds of events take place?
Well, if we're talking about recent examples, very often we are seeing right-wing groups and right-wing perspectives that are often the target of censorship. Hasn't always been like this. I mean, if we go back to the 50s and 60s, there was a time when it was the left and their protests against perhaps the Vietnam War, their protests in favor of civil liberty legislations, ending desegregated schooling, that sort of thing. That was the contentious idea that was subject to censorship. But these days, it is criticism of feminism, of radical feminism. It is men's issues. It is abortion debates. My organization has been involved in debating abortion on campus. We take the pro-choice side, but very often these debates get shut down by well-meaning, but unfortunately not well-applying student unions that use the wrong methods to defend their morals, which they see to be superior to the rest of us.
So whereas once upon a time it would have been, if I can sort of characterize it generally, left-wing student radicals unhappy with a particular issue, trying to shut down debate, now you're seeing more of right-wing student radicals doing it.
Well, now those student groups have, in a weird sense, become the establishment. And so when there are events on campus, and I gave the abortion debates, but there are others, where those debates are seen as an affront to the rights of women, perhaps, that they might create a dangerous space on campus, then in the name of preserving a safe space, these often left-wing groups will take it upon themselves to do things like bullying and intimidation and harassment, which themselves constitute an affront to preserving a safe space on campus.
Okay. Alice, we mentioned a couple of examples off the top. You got the Mozilla case, the Ian Hersey Alley case, the former owner, or still owner, I guess, but maybe potentially soon to be former owner of the LA Clippers. We've heard this referred to as the culture of shut up. Do you think that's an apt description of the kinds of divisions we're seeing nowadays?
Absolutely not. There are lots of things that contribute to a culture of shut up. The end of net neutrality contributes to a culture of shut up. Government silencing of scientists contributes to a culture of shut up. State surveillance of private correspondence contributes to a culture of shut up. Students protesting controversial speakers, that's an example of free speech. It's not the end of free speech. So I was only recently made familiar with Janice's experiences. I had the chance to watch them on YouTube. And what I saw warmed me. I saw people who cared very much about gender issues, some identifying as feminists, some identifying as men's rights activists, vigorously, wholeheartedly, and determinedly engaging with each other, yelling, not always being polite. And as a result, I know that Janice's work has received a much wider audience, including a platform on this show. I think this is the very opposite of silencing, and it's how a society of free speech works.
I'm not sure you saw it that way, did you?
No, I most certainly wouldn't say that. I think that's a complete mischaracterization. What happened at Queen's University was precisely that. There were a lot of angry comments during my talk, laughter, heckling, that sort of thing. But the talk was able to go forward. And then there was a heated, but I think productive question and answer period afterwards. That is the definition of free speech. When a speaker is actually not able to go forward with the talk, that is not an example of free speech in any way. That's bullying and intimidation, and it's, I think, to be deplored. I've had emails from people afterwards who talked about how they had driven, for 45 minutes because they lived outside of Ottawa to come and hear my talk. They weren't able to hear it because it was shut down by a few students who felt that they had the right to determine what ideas could be.
Oh, yeah, I would love to jump in. Thank you. Well, I think it's important to talk about what we mean by free speech. I care a lot about free speech. I teach John Stuart Mill. I'm committed to philosophy. We started because Socrates was silenced. Free speech means freedom from government interference and sanction. It doesn't mean freedom from consequences, and these consequences can include vigorous reactions, criticisms, protests. Unfortunately, it can even mean that debate doesn't happen or doesn't go the way you'd want it to.
Consequences, if I may get in here, because these I was at these events as well. The consequences were violations of university policy. Yep. Okay, policy on free speech, policy on the non-disruption of sanctioned events. Doors were blocked and fire alarms were pulled. That's
absolutely
dangerous.
And listen,
blocking the exit after pulling the fire alarm.
No mainstream feminist, including me, none of us are ever going to defend the pulling of a fire alarm. You can point to a single mainstream feminist thinker or defender who wants to defend the idea of using fire alarms to set people down,
okay,
I will personally
apologize
to them.
Rachel's been unbelievably patient so far.
Rachel, yes.
Come on in here and give us your view on where are you on this?
The Charter of Rights and Freedoms guarantees freedom of expression. It doesn't guarantee you the right to have to dispel your drivel, really, just untruths to impressionable minds with a mic, an amplifier, and an audience of impressionable students.
What are you referring to there?
I listened to the YouTube video of the professor at Queen's, and when students laughed, it was because she was saying stuff that was not true, and it drew laughter.
For example,
that was their reaction to hearing presentation of ideas that were just not based on any fact that could be backed up.
Could you give an example of something that you found? Okay, could you give an example of something that you found so egregious that it deserved to be laughed down or fire alarms pulled or whatever?
I don't agree with the fire alarm is pulled, but when somebody says that the statistics that we've been based on forever are wrong, and therefore, you know, rape is not as much of an issue as it should be, I think that draws laughter, if not crying, because it's just so preposterous. So if she wants to speak, that's fine, but she doesn't get to have the forum of our public universities, paid for by my and your taxes, to disseminate that information that's just not right.
Well, these are public universities. We all pay through tuition subsidies that come from the government. Many of us are students at these universities and have differences of opinion, and we all pay tuition to attend them. The thing, though, is if we can pull back for a second, free speech starts from a very simple premise. I may be wrong. I am fallible in my opinion. I mean, you were just referring to what happened, what Janice was saying is drivel. I don't think that I am in a position where I can decide for everybody's sake what's drivel and what's to be heard. And when we have opponents who set themselves up as arbiters, who block the door so that other students can't judge for themselves what's drivel and what's maybe a gem of wisdom, I think there's a problem there.
And I think the problem is
Janice
confusing.
First talked about how it was radicals who were against her. So she characterized people who were against her as radicals when they're just citizens with opinions that are offended by what she's saying. And the characterization of radicals is already starting in that direction that she started, actually.
Alice?
Absolutely. I might add that many of Professor Fiamangel's talks start by characterizing a whole swath of her colleagues as intellectually empty, incoherent, and dishonest. This is exactly the sort of conversation move that's designed to provoke a fierce, angry, or laughing response. I'm with Rachel on this. If you set out to say things designed to offend and harm people, you can't complain that your free speech is being violated when people respond with offense, anger, and protest.
Is that what you're doing?
I would certainly never complain that my free speech was violated because people responded with anger or laughter. My point about the Queen's speech was that was an ideal example of freedom of expression and of lively debate. I don't care if people laugh at what I have to say. And yes, I'm deliberately provocative to some extent in my speeches because I want people to engage in a lively manner. But to absolutely shut me or anyone else down to prevent me from expressing my views is a violation of free speech. And to say that
free speech doesn't mean free ride, though, does it?
No, well, nor does it mean you're guaranteed a platform to speak.
Okay, that's just a small part of a debate. It's worth watching the entire debate. As someone who has taught at universities and colleges for the last 35 years, nearly 40 years, what I'm seeing is I'm seeing mainly coming from the relatively small group of students who believe that anything that is said that challenges their preconceptions on everything, anything, should not be allowed. And now the administrations have caved to this, so you have an enormous amount of money being spent on these administrations that are trying to protect the student from dialogue that those of us who grew up appreciated. Have lively debates, share differences of opinion, challenge those you don't believe in, but don't censor them. Because when you don't allow someone to give their point of view, no matter how hard you may consider it, you're engaging in censorship. Now, where does that take you? Once you allow that you can shut someone down, then it goes into the classroom. And the consequence of this on the outside from speakers is now it's on the inside. A person, for example, did not say a single thing that anyone could possibly find offensive, and yet got an anonymous complaint, and that person had to go through a whole review system. They were not allowed to teach in the process, and they were finally challenged with their tenure. That's how bad it is. So now any student knows they actually have more power in that classroom than the professor. And now there were people complaining and actually protesting they shouldn't have to take exams. They shouldn't have to take final exams. Others protested, I think it was Brown University, that they shouldn't have to attend classes. So I actually saw this, where two students sat outside the classroom, everyone's classroom, never took a class, not one single class, not one single test, not 1 hour in any classroom, and they got a college degree. Two of them. Because they knew they could. And the entire university went along with it. I quit. I told the dean I would not teach in an institution that was allowing this. And I said, remember this. This is only the beginning. And now it is full-fledged avalanche. The standards have come down. And so you can graduate today with an degree. It doesn't mean that you have anything intellectually behind that degree, unless it's in special fields, such as engineering and architecture, medicine, nursing, etc. But liberal arts, it's a joke today. And it used to be a powerful input. My suggestion is, if you want a good education that's going to help you in the future, think carefully. There's only 7 fields that you can be guaranteed of work that can help pay off your student debt if you have it and provide you with a quality of life living. Instead, go into trades. Go to trade schools. Learn masonry and glazing, roofing, framing, carpentry, electronics, plumbing, irrigation. There are more jobs than there are people to fill them, and they frequently are $40 to $50 an hour. And people are now beginning to heed that, and I believe it's important they do so, because those are the crafts that people actually need. You don't really need someone who has a background in French literature, unfortunately, but that's the way it is. It's a different world out there. But I'm concerned about this because once they tell someone on the right, we don't want to hear what you have to say. Don't even speak here. If you speak here, we're going to burn the place down, break all the windows, set cars on fire, small businesses on fire, and they have. Then do you think they're going to stop with the right? They're going to go to the left. And now you see it. Some of the greatest minds in America, Chris Hedges, Abby Martin, Cornell West, and 100 others I could name, Dean Baker, where do they have forms that are acceptable to them now? They've all been withdrawn. Google, Facebook, Twitter. No, there's massive censorship. Now, some of it's being exposed, which is good. But then how do the best and brightest who really are caring individuals, how do they get their messages out? And then what if they've been demonized? Then who's going to want to contact them or read their work? I'd like to hear your thoughts. If you'd like to address this issue of censorship and our intolerance to ideas and the critical mind thought, and what would Socrates think? The woman said he was censored. Yes, he was. Now, what would he say if he were teaching today? And then again, think of the people you would not be hearing at any university today. George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Lenny Bruce. People who broke through barriers. People who provide a forum for others to be able to say something today would not have a forum that they could go to because they would be politically incorrect. What does that say? 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear from you. And when you come on board, we'll take that. In the interim, I also want to give a call out to our sister station, WBAI, to see if we can't help them. And here's the deal. BAI is about $40,000 short of paying its bills going into the new year. There have been major progress with the new program director, Linda Perry, and with the indomitable, always on focus there, Andrea Katz, of trying to help the station, and of course all of its producers. But there's still $40,000 they need. So we're asking 400 of the listeners to each contribute $100 or more, which is tax deductible, before the end of the year. I'm going to give you a phone number at the station that you can call and help the station, all right, with $100. 516-620-3602. Or you can go to the give to the numeral 2, WBI.org. Give, G-I-V, the letter 2, WBI.org, or call this number, 516-620-3602. All right, and we are going to see if we have someone here. And let's see who's coming up. We have Roland, or Ron, is it, what, I'm sorry, I don't know the spelling of your name.
Ronald.
From Long Island. Oh, hi, Ronald.
Yes, good afternoon. I have an idea regarding free speech on campus. My suggestion is that the university, when they accept the student, that they make them sign a contract agreeing to permit free speech, or if they don't, they will be thrown out.
Okay. So you realize no university would do that. No college university.
Why not?
What do you believe is the threat to hear someone say something? Why couldn't you simply allow them to say what they have to say and then provide a forum for people who have a counterpoint of view?
I think that's an excellent idea.
Even bring people on who you disagree with so that the audience could have two people each given the same amount of time. Remember Chris Hedges and remember Rabbi Lerner debating on two separate occasions, one of the great intellects in America, but I disagreed with him, but I certainly respected the depth of his knowledge on issues. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No.
He's a writer. Think for a moment. Hitchison. Now, when you had those two people on stage, each one had people that favored them in the audience. So you would have a disproportionate number of people, you know, praising, let's say, one versus the other. But they both had the same exact amount of time. It was a civil conversation. It was not about personal attacks. And they looked at the issues, and they each made their presentation. Christopher Hitchison would make his presentation in his own way, and then Chris Hedges would make his presentation. One was on atheism. I remember I watched. That is an extremely healthy way of sharing diametrically opposite points of view with an audience that has an opportunity to ask questions afterwards. But you're not burning cars. You're not breaking windows. You're not preventing. Now, what if either one was prevented? What if they said, you, Chris Hedges, will not be allowed to talk because we disagree with you, or you, Hitchison, you will not be allowed to talk because we disagree with you? That is anathema, in my opinion, to a society and what it needs. We need debate. We need discourse. We need a sense of open forums. And the university has historically been one of those open forums. In the 1960s, we made sure that professors knew that we weren't just going to be talked at. If we had an opportunity to challenge back because of something we didn't believe or didn't accept, we did so. But we don't close down a university because we don't like what someone is saying. We either choose another university, another way of learning, or that university we demand provides us with an opportunity to share a point of view. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. I thank you very much for calling in, Ronald. Appreciate it. I'm Gary Nall. We're getting up to the end of our program. So if you want to help WBAI, and I hope you do, overcome its $40,000 deficit, go to give to, the numeral to WBI.org, or you can call that number that I gave. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Thanks for the times that you've given.